Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Reese Ehrlich. Reese Ehrlich is an independent journalist. He does just about everything, audio, video, writing, and he's been to 81 countries all over the world. He travels regularly and reports regularly for 15 to 20 major media outlets around the world. He has done a bunch of documentaries and, you know, many articles. I'm going to mention a couple here. One is a two-hour public radio documentary about the 10-year collapse of the Soviet Union, or the collapse in the last 10 years. That was hosted by Walter Cronkite. And so he also now has been reporting for Canadian radio, for ABC, and for Common Ground Radio. So, and he's most recently returned from a 3.5-week trip to Afghanistan and Pakistan, and that's what we're going to be focusing on today, because for obvious reasons, it's very much where a lot of things are happening, and as so often the case, we don't get a lot of the story, it seems to me. So, Reese, I want to welcome you, and I don't know where you want to start. You say you've recently written about the drug trade in Afghanistan, and I think that that will be of a lot of interest to people. And just what you saw in Afghanistan in terms of the effects of the bombing and how it is there.
Sure. Well, maybe we can just start with a little bit about the civilian bombings. The U.S. has left the impression that the war has been a very clean one, that it was all laser-guided bombs and targeted strikes at military, al-Qaeda and Taliban, that sort of thing. And when you go to Afghanistan, it's quite obvious that that's not the case. You can go in Kabul, you can go outside of Kabul, and anybody will direct you to the areas that were bombed, civilian areas, and it was it's no secret. Afghans are quite well aware of it. You go and you say, and you randomly interview people to make sure that there's not some kind of propaganda effort. So by talking to people that you meet randomly at the street, it's pretty hard to fix a story, because pretty much everybody in the neighborhood knows what went on, and that's what we did.
And it's kind of hard to miss a bomb, it seems to me.
Yeah, you'll be walking along, and there's a mud house, rubble. And then you ask people what happened, and it turns out a U.S. bomb had come in and flattened four or five houses. And in some cases, there were actually military targets nearby, and the bombs, according to the local people, missed. And in other cases, there were no military targets anywhere around for many miles. And they were just... according, again, to local residents, they were accidents. Nobody accused the U.S. of intentionally bombing civilians, but that distinction is not a terribly important one when your loved ones have been killed as a result of the U.S. Bombs.
And I've heard that people think that some people think it was worth it, even if their relatives were killed, to get rid of the Taliban. Was that your experience?
Yeah.
And you were there, let's see, right now it is
the end of February.
You were there a month ago, the end of January.
Yes. Amazed. I was actually quite surprised that some of the people we talked to said, yes, they basically realized that a bombing was accidental, and that the as tragic as it was that their relatives had been killed, they were glad that the U.S. had come and gotten rid of the Taliban. And in the next breath, they would talk about the need for some kind of aid, compensation, the lack of security in the neighborhood and indeed all over Afghanistan, and they expect the United States to supply that. So the U.S. has raised expectations tremendously. The U.S., of course, got rid of the old government, and that's actually rather easy to do. The hard part's going to be establishing a new one that has any kind of credibility. And already now we see people resenting the continued fighting among the warlords and starting to blame the United States for all the things that are going wrong in Afghanistan today.
Mm-hmm. So that's within a month or so that they're seeing that to blame the United States instead of be grateful.
Well, I think I suspect that there's different opinions. I'm sure there's people even now who go back and are still very grateful. And even the people who blame the United States are probably also thanking the United States in the same breath. It's rather logical, which is that if we had been living under a let's say a right-wing fundamentalist Christian government in this country, in which with the rights of women didn't exist, in which Jews or Christians were persecuted. I mean, sorry, Jews or Muslims were persecuted because they weren't Christians, so on and so forth. In other words, a fundamentalist Christian regime, and some outside power came and got rid of it, we'd be very thankful because there was a horrible government. But then you'd have certain expectations about, well, okay, you came in, you claimed to be our liberators, now what's going to go on? So it's perfectly logical, and I think people can hold those differing views all at the same time. The longer the time from when the Taliban fell, the more the people are going to expect some heavy lifting from the United States.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think the United States is planning to give lots of money, right, to rebuild the country.
Well, interestingly enough, as of the time I was there, they had pledged, if you can believe this, $1 million. As of the moment that I was there. And that's after spending $1 billion a month on the war campaign. $1 million in humanitarian aid. Now, since that time, they have pledged many, many millions, tens of millions more through the Tokyo conference, and many other Western countries and Japan and others have also pledged money. But in reality, the money hasn't come through. The only people really providing immediate on-the-ground assistance are the United Nations and various NGOs who save the children and UNHCR and the World Food Program and et cetera, et cetera. The medicine, Doctors Without Borders, and so on. So these groups are in there. They're experienced. They're providing aid. They're providing medical care and housing and, in some cases, education, food, certainly. The United States, is going to take considerably longer for any of the humanitarian aid that the United States and others have pledged to get in. And the government needs it. They say they need an immediate infusion of $100 million just to pay for the wages and to get the government in functioning. There is no functioning government in Afghanistan. I mean, Hamid Karzai cuts a very nice figure with his lambskin hat and his cloak and meets with foreign leaders and may well be well-intentioned. But in fact, there's no army, there's no police. Most government ministries are not even open. Those that are barely functioning. I went into the National Bank. There were dozens of people behind the counters, most of whom doing nothing, and they had one typewriter that I could see for the entire National Bank. So it's just it's in a country that is in massive need of humanitarian assistance, given the destruction of various wars prior to and now, including that waged by the United States.
I just got to ask, I've heard that there were whole villages that were destroyed that, like as you said, were out in the middle of nowhere, and those people don't have any, or it wasn't your experience, I know, of course, you don't know everything, and you were just in both Pakistan and Afghanistan for three and a half weeks, but it's hard to imagine that people wouldn't have a lot of feelings about that.
Now, I did hear that. I didn't go outside of Kabul, so what I was reporting on was the people that I directly interviewed inside Kabul. But I've heard the same thing, which is that for people outside of Kabul, the resentment was much higher against the U.S. And I suspect now, especially, that the bombing has continued. Everyone agrees that the Taliban is out of power. Al-Qaeda is not a significant force, politically or militarily. But the U.S. continues bombing. Now, for the first time, the U.S. has admitted that it's bombing not al-Qaeda, not Taliban, but warlords who are in disagreement with or taking actions against the current government. In other words, the U.S. is siding with one set of warlords against another on the grounds that the ones they've installed in power are the good guys, and therefore they should be backed. And I'm sure that is bound to present a lot of resentment. The other thing that we know that's happened is that one set of warlords will order in a U.S. bombing to attack rivals and say, aha, that's a bunch of Taliban over there, or aha, there's a arms depot. And it, in one case, it's been documented that the arms depot, in fact, was arms being collected by the Karzai government in part of the disarmament program, getting people to give up their rifles and mortars and whatever. They were being stored there, and some rival group gave false information to the U.S., so the U.S. bombed it. So, again, everything that I saw and have seen and heard about since is the U.S. has not won the war in Afghanistan. Certainly the Taliban has been defeated. Al-Qaeda has been defeated. But there is no government there, and the U.S. is now going to be bogged down for many years to come, sorting out, trying to side with one set of warlords against another or using one set of warlords against another.
Mm-hmm. Well, for those who talk about that oil was the whole point of the bombing, to get to have oil going through Afghanistan, I guess. Well, what do you think about that?
I don't think that was the whole reason, or even the main reason. I think that certainly is a factor, and the government, the U.S. government, doesn't want to admit that. But I think it's perfectly understandable that the U.S. can have a multiplicity of motivations for going into Afghanistan. For example, I think they did want to get rid of Osama bin Laden. Remember him? He was one of the guys we were supposed to capture or kill as part of this raid, and his name has seemed to have dropped out of the headlines. We were supposed to capture or kill Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban, and he seems to have dropped out of sight. So, when the U.S. War goals aren't convenient, they're simply not mentioned anymore. I think they really wanted to go after those guys. But very quickly, a whole other set of objectives came to the fore. For example, establishing military bases in surrounding countries. So from, if you look prior to early October when the U.S. started its bombing to today, the U.S. bases had been closed down in Pakistan. The U.S. now has a major bases in Pakistan. The U.S. has military bases in Afghanistan, Tajikistan, and other nearby former Soviet republics. Now the U.S. has so-called temporary bases, which, go back and listen to this tape 5 years from now, and suddenly you'll find out they weren't so temporary. Then they'll still be there.
Yeah, they hardly ever are.
Yeah, it happened after the temporary bases after the Persian Gulf War. They suddenly became permanent. So clearly that was one of the objectives. The other, I think, was to break the Russian control over the oil supplies coming out of the former Soviet republics. If those countries, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, etc., can start dealing with American oil companies and have a separate supply route that's independent of the old Soviet Union and today Russia, then that's a real feather in the cap for the Texas oil companies, of which Bush, of course, has absolutely nothing to do with. And yes, so I think that's where the oil comes in. But people should be aware, the history is that Unocal had cut a deal or was in the process of making a deal with the Taliban to run a pipeline from the Central Asian republics through Afghanistan and into Pakistan. Afghanistan itself doesn't have a lot of oil supplies, but it's an important transshipment route. And UNICAL had to break off those negotiations as the Taliban became more and more isolated internationally, and they stopped the negotiations. UNICAL and other oil companies would certainly love to have that pipeline built, but it ain't going to get built so long as the political and military situation is unstable in Afghanistan. They're not about to invest the kind of money that it takes to build a pipeline just to have some warlord blow it up every other week, as is happening in Colombia. So while that's certainly a medium and long-term goal, and it will take a while to negotiate and cut the deal, you don't just go out and start laying pipe. I think that's certainly one of the goals that the United States would like to see there. It's not an immediate short-term likelihood. Mm-hmm.
And Reese Ehrlich, you mentioned that you wrote, just finished an article about drugs in Afghanistan and in that part of the world. So if you would speak about that.
Yes. Afghanistan was the number one exporter of heroin in the world. It produced roughly 75% of the heroin consumed in the world, which when you think about it, it was one country. That's an absolute phenomenal number. I can go into great detail, but just to pick up the history briefly, the heroin did not exist in Afghanistan and Pakistan prior to 1979. You had poppy growing and opium, but not heroin. After the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and the U.S. began sponsoring the Mujahideen, the people who are today the Northern Alliance, the U.S. encouraged the Mujahideen to manufacture heroin as a way to finance their war and as a way to get the Soviet soldiers hooked on heroin, as the U.S. soldiers had gotten hooked on heroin in Vietnam.
Now, I just got to underline what you said. The U.S. encouraged them in Afghanistan to make heroin.
Okay. I know. For people who have faith in the United States government, that sounds like an outrageous charge, but it's not a charge. It's reality, folks. I spoke with a former heroin smuggler. I spoke with the former head of ISI in Pakistan, that is the equivalent of the CIA. I spoke with a retired brigadier general in the Pakistani army. I spoke with the head of the ANF, the anti-narcotics force, who is that's the equivalent of our DEA in the city of Peshawar, Pakistan, and all of them intimately familiar with the history of drug dealing in that area. And it was obvious that the U.S. Encouraged, facilitated, helped, specifically the CIA did all those things to get the drug trade going. So basically the arms that the U.S. was supplying to the Mujahideen would come in along a certain route from the port city of Karachi, across by truck to the border towns of Quetta and Peshawar, then loaded onto other trucks or onto muleback or whatever to be snuck across the border into Afghanistan. On the return trip, heroin came out. And it was known by the CIA, it was known by the Pakistani government officials, who some of whom became quite rich off the trade. As you can imagine, it's quite lucrative. And it worked. It financed the war, and it got the Soviet soldiers hooked, or at least some of them hooked on heroin. Now, the thing is that the drugs take on a life of their own. That's not something, because it's so lucrative, you have people who become dependent on that. And interestingly enough, by 1999, to fast forward here a bit, the Taliban, under tremendous international pressure, banned the growing of poppy and the smuggling of heroin. And it was effective. According to the United Nations and according to the Bush administration, they wiped out 95% of the poppy production. And the poppy production that was left in Afghanistan was in the Northern Alliance-controlled areas. That is, the areas that are now the newfound U.S. allies. Mm-hmm. So what happened was, when the war broke out, when the U.S. started bombing in October, the warehouses emptied. The price of heroin dropped by 25% in Pakistan, from roughly $800 a kilo to $600 a kilo in Peshawar, Pakistan. And poppy got planted almost immediately in the areas where it was traditionally grown. And the same warlords who had been growing the opium and processing the heroin back in the 80s are now back in power in various parts of Afghanistan. So it's not surprising that we've seen a big upsurge in heroin production. And the real test is going to come later this year, when the poppy that was planted in November is harvested and in the spring and then processed into heroin a few months later. We'll see exactly how much Afghanistan has come back into a position of being a major drug exporter after having stopped for about the last previous year and a half. And the United States is fully aware of the drug dealing that's going on. They should be aware of the Northern Alliance warlords who are dealing the drugs, and the question is, will they be willing to sacrifice the political ties they've made with them in order to go after these drug dealers?
Well, it is kind of a mixed bag, to say the least, since they first encouraged the United States, the first government first encouraged them to make heroin and then told them to stop, got the Taliban to stop. So we'll see what comes next and what happens to heroin in the United States.
Yeah, well, there's a very interesting article in the Financial Times out of London in which they're writing about the fact that the Europeans are very...
We got a loud motorcycle outside. go ahead, Reese Erlich.
Yeah, the European press and European governments are quite ticked off at the United States because historically a lot of the Afghan heroin comes into Europe rather than the United States. And they interpret the fact that the U.S. is unwilling to do anything about the explosion in heroin production to the fact that it's not going to be bothering the U.S. And indeed, a U.S. official admitted that as much to the New York Times in an article a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I do have the impression that drugs are involved in a lot of everything going on in the world, and most of the American public, I think, doesn't understand that, along with a lot of other things.
Yeah I think the way to look at it is, the Bush administration before them, Clinton, every U.S. government postures as this great opposer of drugs, and we have this kind of war on drugs and so on and so forth. In reality, inside the United States and outside the United States, the narcotics trade is an industry. It's a capitalist industry like steel or bananas or anything else. And when it's advantageous to the U.S. government to deal with them, well, then they're just another industry. When it's not, then they're suddenly the scourge and criminals, et cetera. But all you need to do is look at the drug dealing mafia in the United States and the accommodations that they reach with various politicians, the entire state of Nevada, and so on. And you understand, well, if it can work here, it certainly it works in Colombia, where the U.S. is allied with the drug dealing right wing there. So why not in Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm. I was just listening to the radio, and they were talking about the war on some drugs. I thought that was a good way to put it, because some people are getting arrested right now around here as part of the drug war who aren't even doing anything illegal. It's not real clear-cut. Well, Reese Erlich, I think I want to change over to Pakistan. We don't have too much time left, but if you would talk a little bit about what you saw and what's going on in Pakistan.
Sure. It's actually quite fascinating what's happening there, because General Musharraf, who came to power in a military coup 2 years ago, I went there to cover that when that happened, and is now supportive of the Taliban. Pakistan was one of the few countries in the world that recognized the Taliban, and the ISI, their equivalent of the CIA, had helped install the Taliban into power. After 9/11, and the U.S. made it clear to Pakistan that it had better change sides, and almost overnight, General Musharraf turned around and opposed the Taliban and worked for its overthrow. And it's fascinating, because a lot of people, myself included, thought there'd be very big protests in Pakistan, given the depth of, you know, historical support for the Taliban. But it's very interesting. When I got over there, there still is support for Taliban, but there's almost no demonstrations, virtually no demonstrations that have gone on. And that's because the Taliban was backed by the far right-wing jihadists in Pakistan, that is, people we would call Muslim fundamentalists. And they are very unpopular. They're a very small minority. And when Musharraf started cracking down on them, it liberated people in Pakistan, in the sense that these people were domestic terrorists, that is, quite literally shooting up religious opponents, for example, or attacking women on the street because allegedly they weren't dressed properly. And these were real. So the best analogy I can make is if suddenly in the United States, the Bush administration, on one day's notice, started seriously arresting abortion clinic bombers and seriously going after these survivalists in Idaho and so on. And then, much to everybody's amazement, you might have problems with the lack of civil liberties and various other things, but people would be simply amazed that something that, I mean, I'm not talking about arresting a few people. I'm talking about a serious crackdown aimed at eliminating them as a political force. And that's what Musharraf is doing. So interestingly enough, among the more enlightened Pakistanis, among the people who are not into religion,
religious fundamentalism, Musharraf's stock has soared. He's very popular, despite the fact that he's still a dictator, the fact that there's no democracy in Pakistan, and that he's using highly repressive means to go after these people. You know, basically, you're just arrested and thrown in jail with no charges until he decides to let you out. And that's very troublesome wherever that happens, because it basically remains a military dictatorship.
But now a military dictatorship on the side of the same side as the United States government.
That's exactly right, and that's the other contradiction, because part of that is, part of the deal with the U.S. is allowing them to reopen some air bases, and the U.S. is now pushing to make those permanent, and there's a debate going on as to whether that's going to happen or not. And, you know, the U.S. is funneling massive amounts of military and other kinds of aid, for giving loans and so on and so forth. But, again, in the long run, part of the deal was going to be to, or Pakistan thought, to allow greater export of Pakistan textiles to the United States. Well, that ran smack into the face of the lobby in the United States that wants to keep foreign textiles out. So some of the deals that Pakistan had been hoping to get as a result of its tilt towards the United States is not going to happen.
I thought you can't do that anymore because of the World Trade Organization stuff. Isn't it all open?
Oh, ho, ho, ho. You mean you think the World Trade Organization means free trade? No, it means free trade for other people. It doesn't mean free trade for the United States. The U.S. still has massive systems of tariffs on textiles, on garments, on food. Try buying New Zealand beef or Australian lamb in large quantities in the United States, even though it's cheaper and better. Forget it. No, free trade is for those other suckers.
Mm-hmm. Another double standard, or at least double. Well, Reese Ehrlich, what would you like to for people to know in the minute and a half you have left here? There's so many things I'd love to ask you about, having been there actually on the scene in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yeah, I guess the thing to keep in mind is the U.S. has opened up a can of worms in that part of the world, and that seemingly through effective propaganda and other things, the U.S. has portrayed itself as being the number one superpower with incredible, unbeatable military strength. But no war is strictly military. If it was strictly military, the U.S. could bomb anywhere in the world and win. Wars are always political. They've always been political as well as military. And if you've overthrown a government, you have to replace it with something. And if you've killed one set of terrorists, what are you going to do to prevent their relatives and friends and supporters from showing up terrorism somewhere else? If you don't have a political solution, you lose the war. The Israelis, it's happening with the Israelis now. They've got the most untrammeled military might and willingness to use it, and they're losing the war ultimately because politically they can't succeed in attacking the Palestinians in the way they are. So the United States is running into that exact same problem in Afghanistan, and I don't have a crystal ball. I can't say exactly when and how and where, but the U.S. is going to be bogged down for a long time in Afghanistan, and I think it's going to become increasingly obvious that the U.S. has not won the war the way it's claiming.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Reese Ehrlich, thanks very much for this interview, and people can hear you on Common Ground Radio and read your articles where?
The East Bay Monthly in Berkeley and Oakland will have my cover story about the drug trade in Afghanistan in the April issue, April 2002. Common Ground will have probably a total of five of my radio documentaries, and various friends in Canada and Australia can hear it too.
Well, thank you very much, Reese Ehrlich. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.